Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It's my pleasure this evening to welcome Heather Ross to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Heather is an artist, blogger, and fabric designer. Tonight, she's here to share and discuss her newest book, How to Catch a Frog, a memoir filled with beautifully crafted vignettes from her life. Each chapter is a new how-to in which she candidly recounts tales of growing up in bucolic rural Vermont, introducing us to an eccentric cast of friends and family, sharing her adventures in DIY entrepreneurship, evoking laughter, tears, and a genuine sense of appreciation for the little moments that have shaped her creativity. Please join me in welcoming Heather Ross to the Tattered Cover.
This is so exciting to be here. This is such a beautiful, beautiful store. I got into the taxi to come over here, and I told the driver where I was going, and he said, "Oh, you're in for a treat. It's the most amazing bookstore in the world." It's really sweet. And then he told me he was from New York City, which I thought was great. So I'm going to read a story tonight. Most, if not all, it's a stretch to say all, probably, of the stories in this book come back at the end to some sort of a DIY, some sort of a craft project. And at the very beginning of this book, when Melanie Falik, my editor, and I were discussing it initially, it was really supposed to be a lot like my blog was, which is where there were stories, essays that kind of related to the work I was doing in the craft space, in the DIY world. And that was the format that we thought we were going to move forward with. And then after a few months of working on it together and a few harrowing phone calls and a few scrapped outlines, we realized that it was really a book about making a home and making a family and doing that in a time in this culture when we had been raised, a lot of us, and I say we meaning sort of those of us who grew up in the 1970s, with a lot of questions about how to do that exactly and having so many options in how we would approach motherhood and marriage and making a home. And so it really became more about that, more about starting a family and my family, much to my family's vast disappointment. And this story in particular has to do with my family, with my young family, my husband and my daughter. And it starts with a confusing enough sentence, but once you read the book, you'll understand the beginning. It's called How to Make Coffee Logs to Start a Fire. When we returned from Mexico, my sister, mother, and I moved into the one-room schoolhouse on West Hill. Our father was living in Virginia near his parents, and we would see him only sporadically for the next few years. My grandfather had purchased the schoolhouse property from a friend, a Mr. Tyler, who had never returned to it after buying it as a romantic notion for his wife, who had proclaimed it to include the prettiest spot in all of Vermont. It sat on the 20 acres that bordered West Hill Brook on one side and a gravel road on the other. We could walk or run through the woods on a path that had been made by schoolchildren a century before us to the covered bridge that sat over a clear, deep pool at the bottom of a steep waterfall. It was surrounded by rock ledges that were perfect for jumping from. In the summer, the schoolhouse and the land around it were a paradise, but in the winter, it was all we could do to stay warm and fed. The house had come with a resident tomcat that we loved instantly. His name was Teddy, and he was such a wet, black color that even when you were very close to him, it was difficult to make out the shape of his chin or where his legs began. Usually it was just his eyes that you could see, and they were used to convey little else than a mixture of wisdom and intense annoyance. He had already been inhabiting the schoolhouse when we moved into it, so no one knew for sure how old he was. Now, when I think of him living with us, a young, beautiful, broke, single mother and two little girls on top of a cold mountain, and dropping plump mice, still warm and shaggy in their winter coats, on our pillows in the early morning, I believe it was because he knew far better than we did how close we three towed the line of survival. Teddy's strategy for getting through a Vermont winter was similar to our mother's: sleep through it as much of it as possible. In the coldest months, he would curl up for hours and hours under the potbelly wood stove that was our main source of heat. sometimes for so long that his whiskers would begin to twist up at the tips and his thick black fur crackled when you touched it. My sister and I would dry off in front of the stove after our bedtime baths while he watched us suspiciously from underneath, peering out between the chrome claw feet. We would wait until his eyes had closed, yank him out by his thick tail, and run as fast as we could, clutching him in our arms, trying to get him into our bed while he was still hot. Then we would stuff him under the covers and scramble around, holding the blankets down in every direction. The point was not to convince him to stay. It was just to keep him under there long enough to warm things up. He would eventually tear his way free, throwing disgusted glances over his shoulder as he marched back to his stove. We would wake up hours later, with the stove gone out and the house filled with the dusty, cold blue morning light, to find him stretched out with stiff legs against our backs, pushing us slowly off our mattresses, stealing back his heat. My mother's bed was very close to the stove and also to the door that led to the small addition that had been built onto the back of the house where my sister and I slept. My mother had put up wallpaper in our room that had pictures of animals, lambs and kid goats and bunnies, dancing together in a flowery meadow. In the beginning, she had matched up the design perfectly, but then as she worked toward the other end of the wall, she must have decided that it wasn't worth the effort because she stopped trying. My bed was against a wall where the images on the wallpaper didn't match up perfectly, and I would lie on my side and run my finger over the edges of the paper where they overlapped, trying to push the halves of the images together in my mind. We slept under heavy Mexican blankets and wore thick-footed pajamas, but we would still wake up, uncomfortable from the cold, and need to crawl into each other's beds. When I crept into my sister's bed, she would let me sleep next to the wall, where I could press my fingers against the same images where they matched up exactly, and next to her warmth, the cold muscles in my legs and arms would warm and relax, and I would fall asleep. If I looked through the doorway as I walked from one bed to the other, I could see Teddy tucked into the folds of the Mexican blankets on my mother's bed, where he had been since his stove had gone out. My mother was very good at starting fires and at keeping them going. When she brought an armload of firewood into the house and dropped it onto the wood floor next to the stove, there would be three or four medium-sized logs and one or maybe two very large ones. Those were the ones that would keep burning, with luck, and if the dampers were set properly, through the night, and theirs would be embers that would make a crackling morning fire quick work. We had no woodsheds, so the logs would be coated with snow and chunks of ice and would need to be set on their ends, leaning against the chrome skirt around the base of the stove to dry. If the stove went out in the middle of the night, we would wake up cold, and we would find our mother in her flannel nightgown, her bare hands reaching through the door of the stove, a box of Strike Anywhere matches on the floor next to her. We would climb into her bed and pull her blankets over us and watch her work, and sometimes Teddy would watch with us. She sometimes had her boots on under her nightgown, which meant that she had either had to go out for more wood or felt that it might be necessary to give the stove a swift kick. There were two mountains visible from a high spot on our road. They were across the valley, round and smooth like most of the Green Mountains, which are older and more weather-worn than the tall and spiny mountains in the west. One of the ridge lines, the larger and higher of the two, makes a slow S-curve before dropping into the valley. The other is a soft lump tucked into one of those curves, so close in one place that the valley between them rises a bit. Almost every time we drove past the spot where they became visible for a moment, we would point and shout at those mountains and say they looked just like my mother and Teddy asleep together under thick blankets. When there was snow on the mountains, they looked especially peaceful, as though they would be asleep for months, the top of my mother's head barely visible beneath stiff white wool blankets. I have a photograph on my wall now, a tiny black and white picture of our schoolhouse. The house itself is barely visible. Just the peaked roof line and the top of our door can be seen past a massive pile of firewood. It was delivered this way, dumped from the back of a truck right in front of our door, not stacked. That would have cost us extra. The wood in the photo is covered in a fresh foot of snow. It is, to my eye, a photograph of a family who was caught unprepared for winter. They did not get their wood delivered on time or had not stacked it up and protected it with a tarp against the house under the eaves. They must have spent more than one miserable day pulling apart a frozen pile of wood with wool mittens, though I don't remember that. My mother likely did that alone while my sister and I were inside, watching whatever was on the one channel we got on our tiny black and white television, or more likely, harassing Teddy. I see this photo and I remember the way that some of the people in town looked at my mother, as though she must be crazy to be living the way she was, with two little girls on a mountain road in an uninsulated house with no electric heat. I see this photo taken from our road and from the perspective our neighbors must have had as they drove past our house, and I imagine them shaking their heads in judgment as they went by. Some winters our wood would arrive unsplit, It would appear as short logs, trees cut into lengths that would fit into our stove, and my mother would borrow or rent a wood splitter to cut it into sections. When the wood splitter was in the yard, my sister and I were not allowed to go outside. It was a noisy thing, louder than a mower or a car, and spit out a smelly, oily smoke that would cling to my mother's hair for days afterward. She was unimaginably strong, my mother, tall and very thin, with long, thick red hair that was always down and always loose. She was very beautiful. By my math, she was 33, maybe 34, when the photo of the woodpile under the snow was taken. On these fall mornings, she dressed in the rag wool sweaters and thermal undershirts that my grandmother bought her every year for Christmas, with jeans. She had a thick wool fisherman's hat that she would pull over her head, pushing her hair over her ears underneath it to keep it out of her way. She would make herself coffee in a percolator, dumping the dried coffee grounds from the morning before into the stove before making a fresh pot. They would make the fire very hot for just a moment. A bright orange glow would rise up, and we would say that the stove and our mother loved coffee in the morning equally. When she was running the splitter, lifting logs that must have weighed 50 pounds onto its belt and pushing them into a sharp, rotating saw blade, she would get very hot and take off her sweater and then her hat and then even her gloves. And then we would see her through the window, sleeves pushed past her elbows, lifting and pushing, her breath like clouds, until the engine would cut out because she was tired or because she had run out of fuel. And then she would sit on an unsplit log and have a cigarette and stretch her back like a cat, and then the other way, so that she would be looking up at the gray sky, with smoke coming out of her mouth and her eyes closed. Then she would come inside and make us dinner, usually spaghetti, and we would all crawl into her bed together and watch television. Teddy would come out from under the stove, walk over us with heavy, quick steps, and curl up next to her head, where she would scratch him under the chin and pet him. And he would raise his chin and close his eyes, and he would purr. She had boyfriends in those days, but they were mostly not around when we were awake, and they were never there to help with her with things like firewood, though they might have been if she had asked. The only man in her life, as far as we could see, who paid attention to whether the house was warm enough was Teddy. I had forgotten until recently what depending on wood heat means. When Hurricane Sandy inched toward my city, I got an email from my mother, who still lives in Vermont. She has a little house in town now and doesn't live in the schoolhouse anymore. She even has oil heat because after decades of depending on wood heat for survival, after years of battling old wood stoves and undependable weather patterns and inhaling dust and smoke, she decided that she had dedicated enough hours of her life trying to stay warm and put down her axe for good. She also has cable television, which has replaced the potbelly wood stove as the thing she moves her chair toward and that makes her angry and that sometimes gets a swift kick. She watched closely the morning of October 28th, 2012, and could see that storm coming, and went upstairs to her computer and typed out the following message to me. "That Sandy looks mean. Get the fuck out of there. Come here if you want." We were already leaving the city when I got her message. I had packed a week's worth of food and water. I've never gotten an email from my mother that doesn't include a swear word. Ever. Usually in all caps. We were already leaving the city when I got her message. I had packed a week's worth of food and water, our warmest clothing and boots, our battery-powered radio and lanterns, shelf-stabilized milk, my one-year-old daughter, my dog, and my husband into our car, a 4,000-pound 20-year-old Land Cruiser, and was checking traffic patterns. There were moments over the course of that morning when I felt supremely, almost irrationally confident, even as I watched people on the streets below through my bedroom window, carrying on with their day as though there was no reason to flee or even carry a raincoat. It was sunny and bright, and according to the radio, there was no traffic on the FDR, even though an evacuation of Lower Manhattan had been called during a much less severe storm the year prior. But there were also moments when I wondered if I was overreacting. I remembered a dinner party about a year after I moved to the city. We were with some friends of my husband's from business school, most of whom had grown up in or near the city. I had embarrassed myself by launching into a speech after two drinks on an empty stomach about how important it was for each of us to have an escape plan, were there ever to be a catastrophe, natural or otherwise, stressing that the evacuation routes from the city were not adequate. This would have been a perfectly normal thing to say in my formal social circles, in Northern California and rural Vermont, where paranoia and a distrust of public services in the face of natural disasters were standard. But here it was followed by a still silence, a circle of faces with raised brows and wry smiles. Tricia Spielman reached across the table and put her hand on top of mine. "Don't worry, Heather, we keep a car uptown." And then she raised her other hand to her ear with her pinky and index fingers extended to indicate a phone, tilted her head and said, "If anything happens, just call me, we'll come get you." We drove 2 hours to our house in the Catskills, where we also expected to lose power, but knew or hoped that we would be able to stay warm with wood fires, something I had not done for a decade, and even then it hadn't been in a deadly cold. We lost power the following evening, even earlier than expected. We watched two trees, each 60 or 70 feet tall, land on our power lines, causing them to snap in half. TC and I pulled B's crib into our bedroom where we sat awake as she slept with the dog between us, listening to massive pines and firs hitting the ground as the winds touched down. We heard the cable that connected us to the grid snap away from the house and watched it fly towards its other end, still connected to a now downed pole, which hung eerily over our driveway. We made wood fires in our smoky fireplace and stuffed cracks in the windows and doors, but our house was too big to heat with just fireplaces. Plus, the ultra-sensitive smoke alarms wouldn't stop going off, waking us and B every hour and giving us constant headaches. Our house was failing us and clearly needed power to operate. We made the decision to move to a smaller house nearby, owned by close friends. They were in New Jersey, also without power, but were able to get us a message telling us that it was what they wanted us to do, knowing that we would be able to keep it warm with its one central wood stove. We packed everything we could and moved on foot. Our car was trapped by fallen trees through the stormy woods and set up home for the next 5 days in their efficient little house. TC has never depended on wood heat the way I have. He can start a fire and keep it going, but he lacks the inner anxiety alarm that reminds him to maintain it. I had never been dependent on wood heat as a mother before, and I realized quickly that it creates a whole new set of alarms, anxiety, and fear. B was dressed in her warmest clothing. We didn't have running water to bathe her, but I could fill a bucket in the stream or lake and warm it on the gas stove. I fed her and TC and the dog bacon and bread with butter, what TC began to refer to as my anxious Eskimo diet. I made sure we were all drinking enough water, and I watched the stove without blinking. What I could not manage to do was build a fire that would keep burning through the entire night, so I slept with an eye open and got up in the dark in the wee hours and rebuilt it. My baby and husband kept sleeping. It would stay warm upstairs long after the fire had gone out below, but my dog would join me in the cold, sitting next to me as I bent over in front of the stove as it lit up and filled the room with a warm, faded light. I could not go back to sleep, so the dog and I would make coffee with a percolator, dumping the grounds from the previous morning into the wood stove, which would swallow them with a hot belch, and sit together and make a plan to get through the day, silently calculating the amount of water, of milk for the baby, of firewood that we would need. Eventually, my family would wake up and join us, and while we were happy to be safe and warm together, I was getting tired. The fact that my mother had done this with two tiny children and a tomcat instead of a husband for 4 years seemed impossible. In the months after Sandy, I became preoccupied with discovering a way to heat my house with something other than wood. A friend's husband, intrigued by my efforts, got involved. By Christmas, I had a plan. So that story is followed by instructions about how to make logs out of coffee, which, thanks to the proliferation of coffee shops in this country, it's remarkably easy to come by a giant garbage bag filled with coffee grounds. I have one other shorter one. Sorry, I had I'd memorized the page number, but numbers don't stay in my head for very long. Oh, page 100, that was tough. It's nice, though. It comes in handy when you start forgetting how old you are. And this one's called How to Swim a Horse. My Uncle Mike was married when I was 12. His wife, Mary, was a beautiful, dark-haired, blue-blooded woman who was still a student at Bennington College when they met and only 24 when they married. When she moved onto the mountain, she brought some horses with her. My grandparents, who believed in non-team sports like riding, skiing, tennis, and ballet, were convinced without much effort that my cousin's sister and I should learn to ride from her. My grandfather once told me that women who took ballet had the finest posture, and he felt certain that girls who played field hockey did not make good wives, and that women who were not fearful of horses were not fearful of anything. And so Mary raked out a rough schooling ring on the one piece of level ground that dropped away into steep pasture and then into the valley a mile below us, and assigned us each a day of the week, which was when we would come for an hour-long lesson, rain or shine, for which my grandmother paid. There were trails on the mountain, too, including one that climbed all the way up to and then snaked along the ridgeline, spitting you out onto the other side of the steep creek that carved the valley between our mountain and the one to its south. But at a point so high in the watershed that you crossed thousands of tiny streams instead of one rushing one, which is when I learned how a river is made. There was a dark forest trail that crossed a steep gulch via something called a slide, which is when a hillside is so steep and the soil is so loose that the only way down is to give the horse his head, basically give him control, lean back as far as you can and let him make his own way, sometimes stepping with cautious and jarring steps, and sometimes not moving his legs at all, but just sliding on all 4 feet, with his hind legs bent and his nose straight down. The trails, though, were only open to us for the longer rides that were a reward of surviving the grueling hours in the ring for weeks at a time. Mary's father had been a cavalry something or other, and she believed, as he had, that until you could post, which means lifting yourself a few inches off the horse's back repeatedly at a certain point during a trot to avoid the heaviest impact of each stride. I'm guessing since this is Colorado, most of you know that, right? Bareback, using only the strength of your knees and practice timing, you didn't deserve a saddle or stirrups. Mary would put a dollar bill between my knee and the horse and lunge me in circles around the ring for what seemed like full days, and if the dollar was still there when she finally let the horse slow to a walk, it was mine to keep. Mary's sharp commands and short temper kept me focused, and after 2 summers, when she proclaimed me her star student, not much of an achievement really, since by then my cousins and sister had abandoned their weekly lessons, and it was just me who still showed up, I was hooked. Mike and Mary's horses seemed a mismatched lot, a mix of breeds and temperaments, but each with its own character and purpose. Butternut was the Morgan, the beauty, tall, sturdy, quiet, and blonde. She was Mike's favorite. She had come from a very fancy barn called Taproot in Shelburne, Vermont, where Morgans were bred to perfection. Morgans are meant to possess the most athletic qualities of a horse sized for riding, with the temper, sturdiness, and work ethic of a draft horse. Butternut was a magnificent athlete, but she did not like to take orders. For this reason, she had been pulled from the breeding stock at Taproot and found her way to Mike, for whom she was a perfect match. He would let her run her heart out on the last mile home, and when you saw them from Mike's porch coming up the mountain on the dirt road just after the sun had set, from a half mile away, her in a wild gallop and him with both hands thrown forward, almost touching her neck, his tall, lean form balanced in the saddle, almost motionless, you held your breath. Bucky was the old schooling horse. He and I had what you might call a May-December love affair. I loved him in that way that a girl can love a horse or a dog or a kitten, in that painfully smothering way that had been practiced on stuffed animals, and does not consider what unrequited love could possibly feel like. I would stare into Bucky's eyes for solid minutes, hoping to make sort of mental or magical communicative connection, certain that I was getting somewhere. You're making him nervous, Mike would say. He's nearly blind, you know. You're just a big nosy blur to him. I stood on my toes and whispered into Bucky's ear as I gave it a scratch. It's okay, Bucky. I'll be your eyes. He's deaf too, Toopy, Mike said, clearly annoyed and watching me carefully now. Deaf as cheese. I would climb onto his back with just my jeans and rubber boots on and lie on his neck with my arms wrapped around him, my bare chest on his bristly neck where I had torn bits of mane out by the fistful during our lessons. I especially loved to do this when it was raining, which it did on many afternoons, closing my eyes and feeling the steam coming off him and searching for that cosmic connection through his coat. He would wait until I was almost asleep and then reach down suddenly as though he wanted to eat some grass, and then quickly take a step back, and I would slide forward and off and land in a pile at his feet with a thin coat of wet horsehair, some of it gray, on my chest and face. Bucky didn't take me very seriously in the ring either and had to be constantly reminded to stay in a trot or to ignore the favored ferns that grew on the edges of the ring but had been picked clean in his pasture. He liked to step on my foot while I was putting his saddle on his back and then pretend he was asleep as I tried to push him off. Other times he would hold his breath and make his chest big while I tightened his girth. And then when we were in the ring, he would let all of the air out of his lungs so that on the next turn my saddle would slide off his back and onto the side of his belly and I would end up hanging by 1 foot, trying to right myself long enough to pull my feet out of the stirrups and jump off safely before he made a break for the barn doors with me dragging behind in the dirt. But if he had been younger and I had been older, I like to think that we would have had the sort of girl horse love that books are written about, that telepathic transcendent love. I would have been covered in blue ribbons. He would have saved my life at least once from a bear or a near drowning or a pack of wolves. And we would have won a scholarship to one of those horsey colleges where we would have gone together so we would never have to be apart. But time stood between us. And at the end of our 4th summer, Mary sent him and me out on a ride by ourselves and told me to say my goodbyes as Bucky was retiring to a pasture in town. I cried and proclaimed my devotion as he farted loudly enough to scare the birds off the branches all along the half mile stretch of dirt road back to the barn. Cosmos was the young draft horse. He was massive with a shiny wet black coat and muscles that looked like the ones you see in a comic book. He had short legs, which made his center of gravity low and good for pulling things like logs and stone, and the big gentle eyes of a fawn with thick black lashes. He was not the most cunning of animals. Mike needed only to put a fence across the path to keep him from going down to the creek. Cosmos would walk toward it, sigh, and turn around to plod back up to the hill without it occurring to him that he could simply step off the path and walk around it. Cosmo's never startled, never bitter-nipped, and never seemed to get impatient or angry with any of us or the other horses. He was at the very bottom of the pecking order, or horse hierarchy, because he was the youngest and the least aggressive, which seemed to suit him just fine. After he was ridden or worked, he liked to roll in the dust with his short little legs in the air and scratch his back like a giant puppy. And he would sometimes seem to stare into the sky and ponder a cloud, or even close his eyes and let out big snorty sighs. Cosmos was the one that I took swimming in Paradise Pond, which was just over 2 miles away. Horses are natural swimmers, even the big ones. Vermont is muggy in the summertime, for which swimming is the best cure, especially if you are a child or an 1,800-pound horse with a black coat, and especially if you don't have cousins or a modest sister or a mother around to tell you not to take off your shirt. This, said my Uncle Mike, is absolutely the last summer that you are going to be able to do that. He had said the same thing the previous year and hadn't really been able to enforce it, though I had to admit that things were starting to look a little different up top, and he was probably right. I'm serious. People are going to start thinking I'm the funny uncle. I thought he meant funny ha-ha, which didn't seem to relate to the awkward development of my breasts, so I assumed that he was doing us both the favor of changing the subject. On these muggiest of days, you could jump in and feel the sweat and the damp hot air and the dirt or most of it leaving you in the water. You could even open your eyes underwater and see it pulling away from you in a cloud. When you ride your horse into the water, the cloud around you is at first opaque and mixed in with the mud or sand from the bottom. And when the water around you is clear, you know that your horse's feet aren't touching the bottom anymore and that you are swimming. When you are riding a swimming horse, it's important to keep your whole body flat and near the surface, and to keep your feet up on his back because his legs are moving much more quickly than when they are on the ground. And if you were to get swept up in those legs, you could get kicked very hard more than once. Cosmos's back was broad enough that you could stand on it and pretend that you were in the circus. And if you were light enough, dive from it into the water and then swim back to him and pull yourself back on over and over again. And after, when I rode him home, I would tie up his reins in the long pieces of his mane so that they wouldn't slip over his head and trip him up, and I would stretch out on his back with my head on his rump and look up at the sky. Peggy was the bitch. I always suspected that it was because she knew that Mike loved butternut the most, but it could have just been the way she was. I avoided her most of the time, but I always felt like she was watching me, waiting for me to acknowledge her and her impressive status among the other horses. One summer, on Mike's birthday, my cousins and I brushed out her mane and tail and braided them. Into each of the braids' creases, we stuck wildflowers that wilted almost immediately. Peggy seemed to like the attention at first, but soon enough she grew impatient. My cousins and sister backed away after her first bitchy little stomp, but I persisted. This had become an art project, and I was not about to let my work wander off. When she was completely covered, I paraded her into the ring and made her stand so that the group on the porch could admire her. "She looks like Carmen Miranda," shouted Mike, lifting his beer bottle toward us. Peggy shifted her weight. Someone pitied us and gave us a gentle applause, which she recognized as her cue to pull me back to the barn. She walked quickly and then broke into a trot, yanking me with her, a few of the daisies flying off her mane, and I heard some of the adults laugh in a kind way. Back in the barn, I stood in front of her and unfastened her bridle. "You look pretty, Peggy, whether you know it or not," I said to her, smiling with my eyes wide and my brows up, to show her that I was her friend. Her eyes narrowed and met mine, and she moved her nose slowly forward toward my chest. Assuming that she was going in for a nuzzle, I put my forehead against the bridge of her nose, which is when I felt her teeth close around my right nipple through my thin t-shirt. I opened my eyes and put my hand against her mouth and tried to pull away, but she had locked on now with all four front teeth, top and bottom, and was looking straight at me. Her ears were falling back in a sign of aggression, and she was beginning to turn her head slightly, pulling my chest up with her. My mouth opened, but no sound came out. I dropped her bridle and her reins and pulled on her ears as hard as I could until she finally let go, just when I was about to give up, certain that the edges of her top teeth had met the ones on the bottom, and that I had lost an important body part forever. Then I grabbed her tack and I ran away from her and toward the house, my hand over her throbbing chest, over my throbbing chest. I didn't tell anyone what had happened because I wanted to keep riding, and by now every mother but mine had decided that Mike and Mary's horses were not safe to learn to ride on. It was weeks later, after my cousins had gone back to their cities, that I lifted up my t-shirt for my mother while she was in the tub, smoking, and showed her the bite. It was very swollen now, and surely infected. I hadn't been able to sleep on my stomach or even on that side. The skin had broken and then healed and then broken again, and now when I pushed against it, clear fluid came out. I know, sorry. I sort of forgot how gross this was. The bruise around it was as big as an apple, black and yellow, and in one spot a sickly green. My mother sat up and put her cigarette down in the tin ashtray next to her tub. She saw it and pulled me by the forearm closer to her and, looking right at my nipple, said, "What happened to you?" "Peggy bit me," I cried out, tears coming out fast now, "really hard." She sat up straight, backing away slightly, and gave me a hard stare as she lifted her cigarette out of its tray and took a long, slow drag on it. "Who?" she said, adding a pause as though she were trying to stay calm. "The fuck is Peggy?" "The horse," I said. "Mike's horse, the little red one?" she asked, looking a little relieved. "Yes," I answered, "the little red one." She leaned back now, looking at my chest again, and sank back into the tub, holding her cigarette high. Her voice lowered, and she shook her head as she said, "What a little bitch." I gave her a nod in agreement. Then she took another drag of her cigarette and looked at me again and quietly told me to put alcohol on it every day, and that if it didn't make the swelling go down, I was going to have to go to the doctor. She occasionally said that, but it never happened, which was fine with me. A week later, my grandmother dropped off some clothes for me, and among the pile was a little bra. It was an almost useless thing, meant really just to flatten things out until I had something that needed supporting. But once I started wearing it, I also started wearing a shirt, because now, when I wasn't, I looked like I was in my underwear. I had to admit that it was comfortable, especially when I was riding. Mike was right. That was the last summer. Sorry, I totally did not remember how gross that was.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.